Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 191 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be studying a comprehensive review series of endocrinology for the USMLE Step 1 exam. And one focus I'll have over the next couple of days is also to finish up the podcast I have for like the other USMLE Step 1 related subjects. So like finish up the one for gastroenterology, finish up the one for pulmonology, finish up the one for cardio. That will kind of be my big focus. And for those of you that are listening to my podcast, remember that I have complete material for renal. I have complete material for hemonc. I have complete material for for metabolism, right? So I have complete material for all of the pharmacology that's present in first aid, pretty much. So, you know, I've covered a lot of the material. I have fairly complete material for micro as well. So if those are things you're interested in, again, please feel free to consult the website and you'll find a lot of useful information there. And hopefully, like in the very near future, I will just make a topic list that people can just refer to. Like if I'm studying for this exam, for this subject, these are the podcasts that are applicable. And then I will try to have it be something that can be updated fairly regularly. So let's just jump right into it. So today I'm just going to be focusing on adrenal glands. Basically, my goal is by the end of today's podcast, you'll feel very comfortable with anything relating in any way, shape, or form to the adrenal glands. So let's go ahead and chat about these adrenal glands, right? So we know that the adrenal glands, right, they are derived from mesoderm, right? And we know that the adrenal glands, I mean, like ultimately, it has two major regions, right? It has like the cortex and it has the medulla, right? The medulla, it's very high yield to remember that the medulla is derived from neurocrest cells, okay? That's something that's very high yield to remember. So it's the cortex that is derived from mesoderm, but the medulla is derived from neurocrest cells, right? And the thing is, one thing your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to know is to know the histology of the adrenal gland. So I'll encourage you to look up pictures of this online, right? Basically, I feel like usually people get confused when they start from the outside in. So I would strongly recommend that you go from the inside out, okay? So the thing is, if you go from the inside out, first you have the adrenal medulla, right? That contains chromaffin cells, right? So you have the adrenal medulla contains chromaffin cells. Because the reason I suggest people start from inside out is if you start from the outside, you may confuse the capsule of the adrenal gland with the cortex of the adrenal gland. And the thing is, the medulla is very distinct. Usually on histology images, it's like you're seeing a bunch of circles, like things that look eerily like neurons, right? So you know that you're dealing with the medulla, right? So we have the medulla on the inside, okay? Again, derived from neurocrest cells, contains chromaffin cells, right? And remember that those chromaffin cells are basically modified postganglionic sympathetic neurons. So they have nicotinic acetylcholine receptors on their cell surfaces. And then if you go higher above that, if you're again proceeding towards the outside, you have the zona reticularis that makes sex steroids, right? And then if you go above that, you have the zona fasciculata that makes glucocorticoids like cortisol. And then if you go above that, you have the zona glomerulosa, right, that secretes aldosterone. It's called glomerulosa because it's responsive to things that come from the kidneys, right? From the, if you want to be more specific, from the juxtaglomerular cells of the kidneys, ultimately with some, give or take a few more steps in the way. And then after that, you have the capsule that covers the entire adrenal gland, right? So again, very important to know that. And the thing is, if you want to remember those layers of the adrenal cortex, right, there's this mnemonic, right, GFR, salt, sugar, sex. The deeper you go, the sweeter it gets. I mean, everyone has heard this mnemonic, right? So it's like zona glomerulosa, right? Again, makes mineralocorticoids like aldosterone. Fasciculata makes glucocorticoids like cortisol, right? And then reticularis makes androgens, right? Androgens, so you can see sex steroids. For the most part, the zona reticularis makes like DHEAS, and it also makes androstenedione. Those things are ultimately converted in the ovaries, right? By an enzyme known as aromatase, right? Remember, aromatase converts androgens to estrogens. And again, the medulla, right? Like I said, it makes catecholamines, chromaffin cells derived from neurocrest. And one, I guess, key anatomical piece of detail you want to keep at the back of your mind is, remember that there's this weird abdominal blood vessel relationship that obtains on the left versus the right. Most things on the left end up draining into the renal vein, okay? Before they then drain into the inferior vena cava. But most things on the right, they drain directly into the vena cava, right? So the classic ones they love to test on the USMLE exams are the adrenal veins, the gonadal veins, right? So let's say like the left testicular vein or the left, ovarian vein or whatever, right? So that's actually very high, you have to keep in mind. The adrenal vein on the left, it actually drains into the left renal vein before it goes into the IVC. But the adrenal vein on the right, it actually drains directly into the IVC. Okay? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that came in like 2 days ago? This patient came in with like severe headaches, temperature of 102. This patient has no core rigidity. And then they tell you that, you know, this patient was given antibiotics, but they continue to get worse, right? And let's say maybe they tell you that, oh, they did a lumbar puncture and they did like a gram stain of the CSF fluid and they saw like gram-negative diplococci. And then now this person is becoming persistently hypotensive. This person is becoming hypoglycemic. This person is, they give you like a CBC and you notice that the person's eosinophil count is going up and the patient's sodium is like 125, the potassium is like 5.8. If you see all those things, what are you thinking about? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. Okay, Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. Remember, it's adrenal insufficiency that arises because these people have like disseminated meningococcal infection, right? So Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, it will touch the adrenal glands. If you touch the adrenal glands, right, you'll basically have labs that are consistent with adrenal insufficiency. So those people will have hyponatremia because aldosterone is not around. They will have hyperkalemia because aldosterone is not around, right? They will have a metabolic acidosis because aldosterone is not around, right? So those are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And they will also have an eosinophilia. Because remember that corticosteroids like cortisol, they actually cause apoptosis of eosinophils. So whenever a person has low levels of cortisol, for example, in the setting of Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, then there will be decreased apoptosis of eosinophils. So eosinophilia will be a classic finding that you will see on a CBC, right? So again, that's something actually very high yield to know, right? Because some people, I'm sure they've always wondered like, oh, why is it that when a person has Addison's disease, their eosinophil count goes up? Well, that's the reason. Because again, corticosteroids cause apoptosis of eosinophils. And in Addison's disease, your corticosteroid pool is gone, right? Because you've had an autoimmune destruction of the adrenal cortex. So what are the things that ultimately control the release of hormone from the adrenal gland? Well, the thing is, the first axis, I guess I'll talk about these things in axes, okay? The major axis I think I will talk about first is like the HPA axis, right? So like the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, right? So that axis is the thing that ultimately controls the production of cortisol. Well, the thing is, it all starts in the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus. Okay, remember the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus, one very high yield thing you should know for exams that it produces is oxytocin. But another thing it actually produces is corticotropin releasing hormone, CRH. Okay, and then that CRH travels to the anterior pituitary and acts on CRH receptors. Okay, CRH receptors, it is very high yield to know that they are G protein coupled receptors, they are G stimulatory coupled receptors. So when you activate them, you actually have an increase in cyclic AMP. Okay, so cyclic AMP is basically the second messenger for the CRH receptor. But remember, the CRH receptor will be found on the surfaces of corticotrophs that are in the anterior pituitary gland. Okay, and then when CRH acts on those corticotrophs in the anterior pituitary, they begin to release ACTH. Okay, and look at the name, adrenocorticotropic hormone, right? So that means it's a hormone that is tropic. That means it goes to the adrenal cortex. Okay, so the thing is, ACTH, you know, is released and then it goes and acts on ACTH receptors that you find on the cells that constitute the adrenal cortex. And those ACTH receptors, they're also G protein coupled receptors. They are responsive to, basically, right, like they are G stimulatory G protein coupled receptors. So your levels of cyclic AMP actually go up when you attack those, right? And the thing is, ACTH, right, it literally causes a hyperplasia of the adrenal glands, right? That's why if a person has very high levels of ACTH for whatever reason, they will have hyperplasia of the adrenals. They will typically have bilateral adrenal hyperplasia. And the thing is, right, when ACTH, you know, acts on its receptors, the zona fasciculata, for example, right, begins to make cortisol. And that cortisol will then exert negative feedback, right? It will shut down the release of CRH from the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus. And then it will also shut down the release of ACTH from the anterior pituitary gland. Now, one quick thing I want to say, because it will be useful for some conditions we'll talk about later, is this fact that our levels of cortisol are actually highest just before you wake up in the morning. The way I just kind of remember that is when you wake up in the morning, you need to attack the day like a lion, right? So because you need to attack the day, you need energy, you need glucose and everything. And cortisol is a diabetogenic hormone, right? So your levels of cortisol are very, very high just before you get up in the morning, right? But at the end of the day, you know you're going to sleep. You don't need as much energy. Your metabolic needs go down, right? So levels of cortisol are actually very low just before you go to bed, right? Right around midnight, your levels of cortisol are very low. And the thing is, there are many reactions in the adrenal glands. To be honest with you, you probably don't need to memorize most of them. But there are some key ones that I would strongly recommend making sure that you understand. And I'll begin to mention them as we go along in this podcast. One key one you want to keep at the back of your mind is that ACTH, the way it actually increases the synthesis of most of the hormones, right? The steroid hormones. Remember, the adrenal cortical hormones are all steroid hormones. One way ACTH increases the synthesis of adrenal cortical hormones is to actually activate an enzyme known as cholesterol desmolase, okay? Cholesterol desmolase is a very, very high-yield enzyme you want to know for the USMLE Step 1 exam. It converts cholesterol to pregnenolone, okay? Pregnenolone, okay? So, again, ACTH activates cholesterol desmolase, converts cholesterol to pregnenolone. And then one other thing I also want to talk about is, if you're looking at the aldosterone, right? The thing is, aldosterone is actually not under the control of the ACTH system. It's actually under the control of the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system, right? So, for example, if you have a release of renin from the juxtaglomerular cells of the adrenal glands, right? That renin will convert angiotensinogen, which I believe comes from the liver, into angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 then travels to the lungs, and then it's converted by the endothelial cells that we find in pulmonary capillaries to angiotensin 2. And then that angiotensin 2 has a lot of functions, right? One function of angiotensin 2 is that it goes to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex and causes the release of aldosterone, okay? It goes to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex and causes the release of aldosterone. And the thing is, obviously, right, whenever a person has high levels of aldosterone, they will have a hypokalemia, right? And they will have a mild hypernatremia. The reason they will have a mild hypernatremia is, if you remember from my renal video, right, or my renal podcast, when a person has high levels of aldosterone, one of the things aldosterone does is that it increases the activity of the ENaC channel that you find at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct, right? So if you increase the activity of that ENaC channel, you will draw sodiums into the principal cell, right? So you get hypernatremia. But at the same time, as you're drawing those sodiums into the principal cell, you're creating negative charges on the urine side, and that will draw potassium ions out of the principal cell, right? So you essentially waste potassium in the urine, so you get a hypokalemia. So when a person has aldosterone excess for whatever reason, they will have hypokalemia and they will have a mild hypernatremia. Another thing those people will have is they will have a metabolic alkalosis, okay? And the reasoning behind that is, if you remember in the nephron, in the distal nephron, we also have something known as the alpha intercalated cell. The thing is, the alpha intercalated cell has a proton pump on its apical surface, its urine surface, right, that is responsive to aldosterone. So the thing is, when you have high levels of aldosterone, you will increase the activity of that proton pump that you find on the apical, or you can see the urine surface of the alpha intercalated cell in the distal nephron, and that will lead to the secretion of protons, right? So you waste protons in the urine, so you develop a metabolic alkalosis. Now, one thing I think I also want to mention, because I guess I don't necessarily want to mention it later, so that I can be more efficient, is this whole thing about like the dexamethasone suppression test, right? So the dexamethasone suppression test is a test that will come up in later part of this presentation, where I'll talk about like certain causes of like hypercortisolism. The thing is, basically, right, dexamethasone is a synthetic glucocorticoid. The thing it does is that if you give a normal person dexamethasone, right, the thing that will happen is you will suppress their levels of cortisol, because the dexamethasone will shut down the production of ACTH. And if the ACTH is shut down, then you will stop making endogenous cortisol, right? So cortisol normally suppresses in response to low-dose dexamethasone, okay? Now, let's assume a person has something known as Cushing's disease. Remember, Cushing's disease is a cause of Cushing's syndrome, right? The thing is, this is one terminology that seems to, kind of mess with people's heads a lot. So let me try to break this down for you. Cushing's syndrome is a syndrome that is highlighted by any person having signs and symptoms of hypercortisolism. If you have very high levels of cortisol for any reason, you are said to have Cushing's syndrome. But Cushing's disease is a cause of Cushing's syndrome that arises from an adenoma in the pituitary gland that's secreting ACTH. So Cushing's disease is a specific cause of Cushing's syndrome, okay? Cushing's disease is a specific cause of Cushing's syndrome. Cushing's disease is just an adrenal adenoma making a ton of ACTH, which is the cause of hypercortisolism. The thing is, when people have like this ACTH, like secreting a pituitary adenoma, when you give those people low-dose dexamethasone, their cortisol levels will actually not suppress, okay? So on administration of low-dose dexamethasone, levels of cortisol actually does not go down when a person has Cushing's disease. But if you give those people high-dose dexamethasone and you check their AM cortisol, remember I said your cortisol is highest in the morning, you know, you check the AM cortisol, right? So, I mean, obviously, if you're suppressing something, that means you're looking for that suppression at a time when that thing is supposed to be high, aka in the morning, right? So when you give a person high-dose dexamethasone, you will actually go ahead and suppress their AM cortisol, right? So that's like a kind of like a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with Cushing's disease. And remember, Cushing's disease, right? Obviously, this is a cause of hypercortisolism that will be associated with elevated levels of ACTH, right? And then if a person has like ectopic ACTH secretion, right? That's the one that does not suppress. That's the cortisol that would not suppress. Like again, the AM cortisol would not suppress. Whether you give low or high dose dexamethasone, it does not matter, okay? But one sneaky thing your friends at the MBME can actually do to you is that they can actually give you a question about a person that has AM cortisol that does not suppress with low and high dose dexamethasone, and the person actually does not have any ectopic ACTH secretion. What kind of condition can you think about that will be associated with non-suppressed cortisol production, like AM cortisol production, without the presence of ectopic ACTH production? What condition can you think about? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about like a person that just has a tumor in the adrenal cortex that's making cortisol, right? If you have a tumor in the adrenal cortex that's autonomously secreting cortisol, then it's not going to respond to low or high dose dexamethasone supplementation, right? So you may say, okay, so Divine, how do I differentiate between an adrenal adenoma that's secreting a ton of cortisol from Cushing's disease or ectopic ACTH production when a person has okay, let me put it this way. Your question may be, oh, Divine, how can I separate a cortisol secreting adrenal adenoma from like ectopic ACTH production that also does not suppress with high and low dose dexamethasone? Well, the thing is, look at the levels of ACTH. If the levels of ACTH are low, then that means you have cortisol secretion from the adrenal cortex, okay? And that would happen because the individual is suppressing the ACTH normally through negative feedback, right? But if a person has ectopic ACTH production, their ACTH levels will be high. So that's how you tell those two things apart. Now, one weird thing, this is probably less likely to show up on step two, but this is very likely to show up on step one, is say, for example, a person does like a low-dose dexamethasone suppression test, or you know, you do one of these dexamethasone suppression tests and you're like, these results are not very interpretable. If you want to really figure out if a person has like Cushing's disease as the cause of their hypercortisolism, one nifty thing you can actually do on an MBME exam is actually to do something called inferior petrosal sinus sampling. Okay, inferior petrosal sinus sampling. The thing is, the inferior petrosal sinus is a vein, right? I mean, all those sinuses in the brain, not vein, in the brain, okay, they are known as venous sinuses. They're just modified veins for all intents and purposes. So the thing is, if you check the levels of, in a person that is normal, if you check the levels of ACTH in the inferior petrosal sinus, it should be roughly similar to the ACTH that you find in most other veins of the body, right? But if a person, for whatever reason, has a local increase in ACTH secretion, for example, in the setting of like Cushing's disease, where they have a pituitary adenoma that's making a ton of ACTH, when you measure the levels of ACTH in those people's inferior petrosal sinuses, it'll be a lot higher than the ACTH that you would find in like some other vein in the body, right? So if you notice, you're like, man, this person's ACTH in the inferior petrosal sinus is way, 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 way higher than what I see in like in, I don't know, like the left renal vein, for example, then you should suspect that the person very likely has Cushing's disease. And again, remember all this ectopic ACTH, the poster child of that on MBME exams is small cell lung cancer. Remember, small cell lung cancer has all these paraneoplastic things like ectopic ACTH production that, again, does not suppress with low or high dose dexamethasone, right? And then they will also have SIADH, right? Because the tumor can produce a ton of ADH. And then in addition, those people can also have Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, where the tumor makes autoantibodies against the presynaptic voltage-gated calcium channel, right? So that's the muscle weakness that improves with use. Again, these are all, I know you may say, oh, Devine, you're going too much on the deep end with these. I promise you, I am not going on the deep end with these. These are things that are actually very high yield and very important to know. So the next thing I think I want to go ahead and talk about, let's see, how do I drive this? I think the next thing I will go ahead and talk about is, let's actually talk about the things that are done by these different hormones that come from the adrenal glands, right? So again, we know that the adrenal glands, again, we have the cortex, that's probably the biggest one we care about, right? We have the mineralocorticoids coming from the glomerulosa, the glucocorticoids coming from the fasciculata, and the androgens, so the sex steroids coming from the reticularis, right? And then we know that the adrenal medulla produces like epinephrine for the most part, although it also to a limited extent produces like norepinephrine and like dopamine, right? And that should make sense if you've listened to my biochema video, right? So the thing is, cortisol, I mean, probably the one of the more important, although all of them are important, don't get me wrong, but probably one of the more important cortical hormones, right, is cortisol, right, the glucocorticoids. So let me go ahead and talk about those first, right? So the thing is, glucocorticoids, they do many things, right? Like they help you adapt to stress, they help you adapt to fasting, they help you deal with like metabolic injury, right? They help you deal with like surgery, right? They raise your blood pressure, right? Because they actually because remember, cortisol is a steroid hormone, right? So it works at the nuclear level, right? So one thing it does is it actually increases the production of like the insertion of more alpha-1 receptors on the surfaces of arterioles, right? So obviously, if you put more alpha-1 receptors, then you then be more responsive to catecholamines like norepinephrine, for example. So you have an increase in systemic vascular resistance, and that can cause hypertension. Well, another thing that cortisol also does is it also kind of like causes insulin resistance, right? That's why most people that are on long-term corticosteroid therapy, they tend to have diabetes, right? And then some other things that steroids do, right? Again, they actually raise your blood glucose levels, right? They stimulate gluconeogenesis, and they actually also stimulate like the breakdown of fat, like lipolysis, they stimulate the breakdown of protein. And one other thing cortisol does is it actually shuts down the activity of fibroblasts. So think about it. If you shut down the activity of fibroblasts, then you will not be able to synthesize collagen appropriately, right? That's why people tend to have like purple striae, or sometimes you may see pink striae on an MBM exam in people that have, you know, pretty high levels of cortisol. Now, probably one of the bigger, I guess maybe more from a pharmacological perspective, uses of corticosteroids, right, is that they actually have the ability to suppress the immune system, and they actually do it in a multitude of ways, right? So one thing they can do is they can kind of like shut down your T cells from producing interleukin-2, because again, remember, they function at the genetic level, right? So they actually shut down your T cells. Your T cells are not able to make an interleukin-2. And if remember, interleukin-2 is a T cell stimulating factor, right? So if you have low levels of interleukin-2, your T cells will not be stimulated. That's why in general, steroids can be used for like induction therapy, or they can be used for like crises when you're beginning to have like organ rejection. And then if you remember, there's this enzyme known as phospholipase A2, that converts membrane phospholipids to arachidonic acid. Remember, arachidonic acid can ultimately go towards the production of prostaglandins and leukotrienes. So one thing that happens is that that phospholipase A2 is actually inhibited by corticosteroids. So you may say, oh, Devine, how do corticosteroids inhibit phospholipase A2? Well, the thing is, again, corticosteroids, remember, they are steroid hormones, so they work at the level of the, like at the genome level. The thing is, they actually increase the expression of a gene known as lipocortin. The thing is, lipocortin is a direct inhibitor of phospholipase A2, okay? So ultimately, if you inhibit phospholipase A2, you will not convert membrane phospholipids to arachidonic acid, so you ultimately not make the inflammatory molecules known as leukotrienes and prostaglandins, okay? Now, if you also think about it, if a person has like really severe allergies, they're told, oh, you know, you can take corticosteroids and that will help. Well, the thing is, histamine and serotonin, right? Remember, they mediate many of these allergy-style symptoms. So it actually does not come as any surprise that the production of actually histamine and serotonin is actually inhibited by corticosteroids. And then one final thing, I guess I'll go ahead and say here. This is just something you do need. Actually, two things I'll go ahead and say here. These are things that are actually very high yield for you to know. Is that corticosteroids, right? Remember, they actually cause demargination of your white blood cells, right? So when a person is placed on steroids, it actually raises their white blood cell count. It shuts down that demyelination pore, right? Basically, essentially makes your white blood cells less sticky to the surfaces of endothelial cells, right? So if a person gets corticosteroids, their white count classically goes up. That's a very high yield thing to know. And then one other thing I also said is that if a person has high levels of if a person has like Addison's disease that is accompanied by low levels of corticosteroids, well, you'll notice that those people will in turn have very high levels of eosinophils, because I said that corticosteroids cause a profound apoptosis of eosinophils. Well, the reverse is the case. If a person has like Cushing syndrome for any reason, then those people will have very low levels of eosinophils, because again, those people's immune systems, eosinophils begin to undergo pretty rapid apoptosis. And that actually kind of explains, again, one of the mechanisms behind corticosteroids being good for allergy-style symptoms, because if you're causing apoptosis of eosinophils, remember, eosinophils mediate a lot of hypersensitivity reactions. If you want to be a little more specific, maybe like the type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. So that's, again, just all high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then aldosterone, I already talked about the effects of aldosterone, that, again, it causes hypernatremia, because it increases the activity of that innate channel at the principal cell of the collecting duct. It causes hypokalemia because it causes the dumping of potassium in the urine at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct. And then it also causes a metabolic alkalosis because it increases the activity of that proton pump that you find on the apical or the urine surface of the alpha intercalated cells of the distal nephron of the collecting duct. And then some other things I think I want to mention, right? Just to, again, kind of like try to integrate a lot of concepts here. If you remember from my biochem review, right? If you remember, I talked about this in this one carbon carrier in the body known as SAM, right? Like S-adenosyl methionine. Well, the thing is, SAM actually plays a pretty big role in the adrenal medulla, right? So it's a cofactor for an enzyme known as PNMT, okay? PNMT, phenylethanolamine N-methyltransferase, okay? PNMT for short. Basically, it's the enzyme that converts norepinephrine to epinephrine, okay? It converts norepinephrine to epinephrine. It is actually very high yield to know that corticosteroids increase the activity of PNMT, okay? So that's actually one of the ways that corticosteroids have a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system, in addition to also putting more alpha-1 receptors on the surfaces of arterioles, right? So that they are more responsive to those catecholamines you are making from the adrenal medulla. And then one other, again, key enzyme I want to talk about is, again, I've kind of talked about aromatase. Remember, it's expressed pretty heavily by cells in the ovaries, right? That's what helps us convert things like DHEAS and androstenedione to estrogens, right? And that should also help you understand why drugs like anastrozole or letrozole or exemestane can be used to treat breast cancer, right? Because those drugs, they are aromatase inhibitors, right? Typically, those drugs are given to women that, you know, need breast cancer chemoprophylaxis for like an ER, PR positive breast cancer, where you need, like in a postmenopausal female, right? Like postmenopausal females, they get these aromatase inhibitors for breast cancer chemoprophylaxis. And again, it's important to remember, testosterone is not the primary androgen that comes from your adrenal cortex, from your zona reticularis. Your zona reticularis, for the most part, gives you DHEAS and androstenedione. So again, I think these are all important things, again, you want to make sure you know and understand. Now, I think the next thing I want to talk about is, let's talk about Addison's disease, right? Let's talk about Addison's disease. You know, it's a pretty high-yield topic to know for the USMLE Step 1 exam for sure. Basically, right, Addison's disease is the most common cause of primary adrenal insufficiency in the US, right? So primary adrenal insufficiency, right? Basically, let me maybe go through some terminology here. Whenever they tell you that a problem in endocrine is a primary problem, it means it's associated with the organ, right? The primary organ that secretes the hormone, right? So like primary adrenal insufficiency means that your adrenal organ, your adrenal gland, more specifically your adrenal cortex is shot, right? But if a person has secondary adrenal, like a secondary endocrine problem, it means the problem is at the level of the anterior pituitary most of the time, right? And then if a person has like a tertiary like problem, it means that the problem typically is at the level of the hypothalamus, okay? Those are all important things to keep in mind. Now, one common misconception amongst people that, oh, like divine, primary adrenal insufficiency means the entire adrenal gland is destroyed. That is not true, okay? That is actually very far from the truth. When a person has primary adrenal insufficiency, the only thing that is destroyed is the adrenal cortex, Okay? It's the adrenal cortex that does not function, not the adrenal medulla. I will say that again. It is the adrenal cortex that does not function, not the adrenal medulla. Okay? Because your friends at the NBME know that this is a common misconception amongst people taking these USMLE exams. So they may try to rub that in to try to get you thinking in the wrong direction. So do not make that mistake on exam. Now you may say, Divine, why would I just destroy the adrenal cortex and not the adrenal medulla? Well, think about it. Those two things have very different embryologies. It's almost like two different organs that are slapped together into one. It's almost like the anterior pituitary and the posterior pituitary. They have somewhat different embryology. They're almost like two different organs slapped into one. So really, disorders that affect the adrenal cortex may not necessarily affect the adrenal medulla. Okay, so again, that's why, in fact, instead of saying the word adrenal insufficiency, to be honest with you, I very much prefer the term adrenocortical insufficiency, because it's the adrenal cortex that is screwed over. Now, what are some things that can cause adrenal insufficiency, right? Obviously, the most common cause in the U.S. is it's an autoimmune disease, right? Addison's disease, right? Remember, on NBME exams, when they give you a question about a person that has one autoimmune disease, they will typically give you elsewhere in the question that, oh, they have some other autoimmune disease. So if they're giving you an Addison's disease question, they can tell you that, oh, this person is taking levothyroxine for Hashimoto's, or the person takes B12 supplementation because they have a pernicious anemia, or the person has vitiligo, or, you know, something to that effect, right? So the most common cause, this is very high yield to know, the most common cause of primary adrenal insufficiency in the U.S. is autoimmune destruction, aka Addison's disease. And then, the most common cause of primary adrenal insufficiency in the world is actually just from granulomas that take over the adrenal cortex. In this case, TB, for the most part. TB is actually the most common cause, very high yield, is the most common cause of primary adrenal insufficiency in the world. In fact, I will say let me be a little more specific. Let's just say more in developing countries, okay? TB will be the most common cause of primary adrenal insufficiency in those folks, right? And I mean, obviously, if a person has Waterhouse-Fredrickson syndrome in the setting of disseminated meningococcemia, that can also cause primary adrenal insufficiency, right? If a person takes this anesthetic agent, etomidate can also cause an adrenal insufficiency. It can actually suppress the production of the suppression of adrenal cortical hormones. That's actually one of those weird things that you don't find in many resources, but it's typically very high yield to know for the USMLE exams. And then HIV, right? If a person has METs, right? Like lung cancer loves to go to the adrenals, breast cancer loves to go to the adrenals. Those things can all cause a primary adrenal insufficiency. And the thing is, again, I've explained what can happen if a person has primary adrenal insufficiency. Those people will be hypotensive, right? Because again, if you have low levels of aldosterone, right, then you are not able to reabsorb sodium in the principal cell of the collecting duct. So you're not able to retain volume, right? So you become volume down. So you become hypotensive. Also, if your adrenal cortex does not work, right, you're not making cortisol, so you are not upregulating alpha-1 receptors on your arterioles, right, so you're not able to increase systemic vascular resistance, so you become hypotensive. You also get mild hypernatremia, right, because again, hyponatremia, because aldosterone is not around, so you're not able to reabsorb sodium. You get a hyperkalemia because, again, aldosterone is not around, so you're not able to waste potassium at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct. And then you also get a metabolic acidosis because those alpha-intercalated cells, their proton pumps do not work, so you do not waste protons in the urine anymore. So if anything, you retain protons. So actually, I'll go ahead and integrate this with renal. When a person has Addison's disease, aka a low aldosterone state, because the adrenal cortex and, by default, the zona glomerulosa is destroyed, those people will actually have a type 4 RTA. Remember, a type 4 RTA is an RTA that arises when a person has a hypoaldosterone state. That's a very nice high-yield integration you want to keep at the back of your mind for NBME exams. Now, one classic thing that your friends at the NBME love to test with regards to primary adrenal insufficiency is that these people have skin hyperpigmentation. So you may say, oh, why do they have skin hyperpigmentation? Well, think about it. If your adrenal cortex does not work and you're not able to make cortisol, well, you will release that negative feedback that typically happens at the level of the anterior pituitary and at the level of the hypothalamus. So you'll begin to make a ton of ACTH. Well, the thing is, ACTH is not made alone. ACTH actually comes from a precursor known as POMC, okay, POMC. POMC literally stands for pro-opio-melanocortin. And one thing you've probably learned about me from listening to all these podcasts is that I love to break down terms, okay? I love to break down terms. Because if you think about it, POMC stands for pro-opio, so pro, Precursor, so pro means, right, if you are pro something, right, that means you are in favor of something. So pro-opioid, right? So the opioid beta endorphin actually comes from POMC. So pro-opiomelano, right? So POMC also gives rise to MSH. MSH is known as melanocyte stimulating hormone, right? So if you stimulate your melanocytes, you'll have hyperpigmentation. That is why skin hyperpigmentation is a classic finding in people that have primary adrenal insufficiency, right? So pro-opiomelanocortin, something that goes to the adrenal cortex, okay? So that's why ACTH also comes from POMC. It is very high yield for the purposes of the USMLE Step 1 exam to know the different derivatives of POMC, okay? You definitely need to make sure you know the different derivatives of POMC. And then, so I've talked about primary adrenal insufficiency. Secondary adrenal insufficiency will be more along the lines of your pituitary gland doesn't work, right? Your anterior pituitary doesn't work, so you don't make ACTH. And then on the flip side, you can also think of tertiary adrenal insufficiency where your paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus has probably been destroyed or whatever, and you're not able to make CRH, you're not able to make corticotropin-releasing hormone, right? So you should definitely keep at the back of your mind that if a person has like secondary or tertiary adrenal insufficiency, they are not going to have, so these are again some very key subtle differences you want to make sure you understand. These people actually do not have skin hyperpigmentation, because think about it. If a person has secondary adrenal insufficiency, well, they're not going to be making ACTH. If a person has tertiary adrenal insufficiency, well, they're not going to be making CRH. So because they're not making CRH, they're not going to be making ACTH either. So those are two low ACTH disorders. So because they are low ACTH disorders, that means you will not have upregulation of POMC production. So that means you will not have upregulation of MSH production. So you are not going to have skin hyperpigmentation if you have secondary or tertiary adrenal insufficiency. Now, one other thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is these people also, people that have secondary or tertiary adrenal insufficiency, they actually do not have electrolyte abnormalities. Like they don't have like, you classically will not see these people having, they will not have like the hypernatremia. They will not have like the hyponatremia or the hyperkalemia or the metabolic acidosis that you come to expect with like primary adrenal insufficiency. Because remember, if a person does not have primary adrenal insufficiency, aka if you have secondary or tertiary adrenal insufficiency, that means that your adrenal cortex is still intact. Because your adrenal cortex is still intact, guess what? Your zona glomerulosa will be functioning just fine. And remember that the zona glomerulosa is not under the control of ACTH. Your zona glomerulosa is under the control of, guess what? Your renin and your tensin aldosterone system. So aldosterone levels typically are relatively okay in people that have secondary and tertiary adrenal insufficiency. So again, that's very, very high yield to keep at the back of your mind. Now, one thing you want to ask, you may ask yourself is, okay, so Divine, how can a person get like secondary or tertiary adrenal insufficiency? Well, here is how. The way that happens is typically it would arise in the setting of a person potentially having like, like they've been on like long-term glucocorticoid use, right? For like some autoimmune disease or whatever, right? And because they're on long-term glucocorticoids, they've just suppressed their endogenous HPA axis, okay? That is, actually, let me go ahead and tell you this. Let me cite some epidemiological things that are high yield to know for the USMLE exams. One, the most common cause of hypercortisolism is just the endogenous use of, the exogenous, not endogenous. Endogenous means it's coming from within you. Exogenous means it's coming from outside of you. So the most common cause, very high yield, the most common cause of hypercortisolism is the exogenous use of glucocorticoids. So basically, glucocorticoids you buy at a pharmacy. Right now, if a person has endogenous hypercortisolism, the most common cause is actually Cushing's disease. Cushing's disease causes like 70% of cases of hypercortisolism from endogenous like causes of hypercortisolism. Probably the second most common cause I will say is probably like an adrenal adenoma or whatever. Either like an adrenal adenoma or something that's over-secreting a cortisol, okay? Those are just weird high-yield things that, again, you may not see mentioned in many resources, but it's very high-yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams. So the thing is, one thing that, again, the reason the USMLE Step 1 and also the USMLE Step 2 and Step 3, the reason they love endocrinology is that it's one of those things where if you don't have deep understanding, you can go off the reservation pretty easily. So they love to describe all these experiments or give you all these scenario based questions and then give you all these arrows, and then you need to understand, oh, this arrow goes up, this arrow goes down, this arrow does this, this arrow does that. So one thing I guess I will go ahead and talk about is, say for example, if a person has primary adrenal insufficiency, right? Their levels of cortisol will be low, right? Their levels of cortisol will be low. So, and again, typically, if you want to say, oh, a person's levels of cortisol are low, it doesn't make sense to measure those people's cortisol when you expect it to be low, aka at night. So it doesn't make sense to do that, right? So if a person has primary adrenal insufficiency, you measure their cortisol in the morning, because cortisol is typically very high in the mornings, right? So if you're like, oh, this person, just before they wake up, you measure their cortisol levels, it's low, well, that's not okay, right? Those people very likely have a primary adrenal insufficiency. So the screening test for primary adrenal insufficiency is to just go ahead and measure their morning cortisol. If their morning cortisol is low, that's not normal. Okay, that's not normal. But remember, for every screening test, you need a confirmatory test. So one way that you confirm the diagnosis of hypercortisolism, of primary adrenal insufficiency, is you then do something called a cosyntropin test, okay? You do a cosyntropin test. Cosyntropin is an analog of ACTH. If you give a person ACTH, you would expect that their levels of cortisol to rise. Failure of a person's cortisol to rise with cosyntropin augmentation is diagnostic, okay? Is diagnostic of primary adrenal insufficiency. Okay, and again, in primary adrenal insufficiency, your cortisol will be low, but your ACTH will be high. But in secondary and tertiary adrenal insufficiency, your levels of ACTH will be low. In secondary adrenal insufficiency, you're literally not just making ACTH. In tertiary adrenal insufficiency, you're not making CRH, so your levels of ACTH will be low as well. Now, there's this thing, I believe I've explained it in a prior podcast, but I'm just going to explain it again, because this is just something that people still seem to confuse on MBM exams, right? And it's this test known as the Mitirapone test, okay? It's a test known as the Mitirapone test. The Mitirapone test. The thing is, the Mitirapone test can help you distinguish between a person that is normal, or let me put it this way, it can help you distinguish between a person that has primary adrenal insufficiency or a person that has secondary / tertiary adrenal insufficiency. So let's explain what will happen with Mitirapone. But I think before I explain what happens with Mitirapone, well, let's actually understand what in the world Mitirapone does. So the thing with Mitirapone is that Mitirapone is actually an inhibitor of an enzyme known as 11-beta-hydroxylase. I'll talk about 11-beta-hydroxylase later, right? But 11-beta-hydroxylase, it's an enzyme that converts 11-deoxycortisol to cortisol. Okay, I'll say that again. Mitirapone is an inhibitor of 11-beta-hydroxylase. The job of 11-beta-hydroxylase is to convert 11-deoxycortisol to cortisol. So think about it. If a person is completely normal, right, and you give them Mitirapone, well, what should you expect? Because the thing is, typically, when they give you these Mitirapone questions, they give you all these arrows that you need to fill in on your exam, right? So the thing is, if you give a normal person, because I feel like, to be honest with you, if you really want to understand endocrinology, always ask yourself, what happens in a normal person? And then ask yourself, okay, what part is broken in this person that has pathology? And typically, you're able to figure things out from there, right? So if you think about it, right, if you give a normal person Mitirapone, you'll inhibit 11-beta-hydroxylase. Well, guess what? If you inhibited 11-beta-hydroxylase, your levels of cortisol will go down, right? And if your levels of cortisol go down, what will happen to negative feedback at the level of the anterior pituitary? It'll be gone. And if it's gone, your ACTH levels will go up. And if your ACTH levels go up, it will basically stimulate everything until you get to that Mitirapone inhibited step, aka 11-beta-hydroxylase. So your levels of 11-deoxycortisol will go up in a normal person. So I'll go ahead and say this. If a person that is normal gets exposed to Mitirapone, their cortisol levels go down, their ACTH levels go up because there's no more negative feedback, and then their 11-deoxycortisol levels go up. Okay? Now, let's assume a person has primary adrenal insufficiency. Well, if a person has primary adrenal insufficiency, well, the adrenal glands The adrenal cortices do not exist. Okay? The adrenal cortex does not exist. If your adrenal cortex does not exist, well, there is nothing. There is no 11-beta-hydroxylase to inhibit, right? So if your 11-beta-hydroxylase is not it's basically non-functional, right? Then your levels of cortisol, right, will still stay low as is, right? Your levels of ACTH will still be increased, and you will not have any changes in your levels of 11-deoxycortisol, right? So basically, like, because whenever you do a lab, right, you know, you measure some baselines, and then you give them a Mitirapone, and then you measure afterwards, your cortisol levels won't change, your 11-deoxycortisol levels won't change, your ACTH won't change. Because basically, if a person has primary adrenal insufficiency and you're giving them metirapone, it's like you're just like throwing metirapone into the sea. You're not going to get anything from it because there's just no place for metirapone to work, right? But if a person has like secondary adrenal insufficiency or tertiary adrenal insufficiency, well, they have intact adrenal glands, right? So guess what will happen? For those people, you know, you measure, if a person has like secondary or tertiary adrenal insufficiency, you check their labs beforehand, right? Obviously, their ACTH levels will be low, right? Their ACTH levels will be low. And because the ACTH levels are low, their 11-deoxycortisol levels will be low. Their cortisol levels will be low, right? But if you then give metirapone, well, if you give metirapone, that metirapone, you'll say, okay, that will suppress the person's levels of cortisol, right? But the thing is, these people, even if you suppress their levels of cortisol, then they will not be able to respond appropriately because their anterior pituitary or their hypothalamus don't work, right? So because those things don't work, you will actually not see any changes in the levels of like ACTH or 11-deoxycortisol, okay? Because again, remember, ACTH drives this whole axis. So if you don't have ACTH, then you'll pretty much not have any changes in anything, okay? So it's just important that you understand the concept of how the body responds, right, under different pathological scenarios to the administration of metirapone. Now, how do you treat primary adrenal insufficiency? Well, obviously, you know, you give those people what they need, right? So you give them the cortisol that they are missing. You can give them like glucocorticoids back. You can give them like hydrocortisone. You can give them prednisone. Remember, prednisone for the most part just has glucocorticoid activity, but hydrocortisone actually has glucocorticoid and mild mineralocorticoid activity. You know, again, you can replace the mineralocorticoids by giving a drug known as fludrocortisone, okay? Fludrocortisone is a synthetic mineralocorticoid. It's like an aldosterone analog, in a sense. And then, I mean, I don't know if most times people don't bother doing this, but, you know, if a person is having, like, very low libido because they're not making androgens, because they have primary adrenal insufficiency, you can give them, you know, you can try to give them, like, some supplementation of androgens, but that's not something you would likely see on an exam. But again, remember, if a person has, like, secondary or tertiary adrenal insufficiency, the aldosterone levels are just fine, so you do not need to give those people fludrocortisone, okay? All you need to give those people is the glucocorticoids that they are missing, okay? All you need to do is to give them the glucocorticoids that they are missing. Okay, so I think with that said, since we've talked about, adrenal insufficiency, it probably, I guess, makes sense to talk about another disorder that may look somewhat like adrenal insufficiency. And this disorder, I think I'll go ahead and talk about, is congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Congenital adrenal hyperplasia is, unfortunately, one of those disorders that you want to make sure that you understand for the purposes of the USMLEs. Basically, congenital adrenal hyperplasia arises when you have some mutation or some deficiency of a key enzyme that is needed to synthesize like one of those steroid hormones that you find in the adrenal cortex, right? And there's three big ones you want to keep in mind for the USMLE exams. The first one is 21-hydroxylase deficiency. That's actually the most common, right? And then other ones we have like 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency, and then we have 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency. And the thing is, you may say, okay, why are these disorders important? The reason they are important, and maybe this will be a nice way for me to set the stage so you can understand them as we go along, is that whenever you have a deficiency of one of these enzymes, typically you have decreased production of some hormone that's supposed to come from the adrenal cortex. But because you have decreased production of one hormone, then the rest of the feedstock to that pathway will then go towards other pathways. So you have hyperproduction of other hormones, right? And one thing I'll go ahead and tell you right now is, in every cause of congenital adrenal hyperplasia, the levels of cortisol are low. That's one thing you can pretty much take to the bank, okay? In every cause of congenital adrenal hyperplasia that you will see on your USMLE exams, the person's levels of cortisol will be low, okay? Basically, the thing that marks you as having, 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency or 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency or 21-hydroxylase deficiency is just basically building from there, like, okay, in addition to having low cortisol, what else do I have, right? That's the thing that will tell you what enzyme disorder you have. And before, again, I teach you what is deficient with these enzymes, I will go ahead and teach you one principle, or I guess one rule, okay? Basically, the rule is, these enzyme deficiencies, because people are like, oh, Divine, do I need to memorize these entire pathways? Probably not, right? So there's a rule you can commit to memory that can help you here. The thing is, if there is a 1 in the first letter, because again, you see these numbers 21, 11, 17. If there is a 1 as the first number of these enzyme deficiencies, those people will have hypertension, okay? If there is a 1 as the first, and I will explain why these rules actually work, right? But let me just give you these rules to kind of set the stage so that you can, you know, feel a little motivated to learn this and learn this stuff pretty well. So again, if there is a 1 in the first letter of the, in the first number of the enzyme deficiency, those people will have hypertension, they will have hypokalemia, they will have metabolic alkalosis, okay? And they will have a mild hypernatremia. But if there is a 1 in the second number of the enzyme deficiency, those people will have virilization, okay? So just remember those two rules, and for the most part, you can recreate pretty much every finding in these different congenital adrenal hyperplasias. And the thing is, it's actually very high yield to know that when a person has congenital adrenal hyperplasia, they will actually have hyperplasia of both adrenal glands. It's not just one that will have hyperplasia, it will be both. Because again, even if it's one adrenal gland that is all screwed up, let's say, oh, you know, it's just the left adrenal gland that has like a 17 hydroxylase deficiency. Well, here's what will happen. You won't be able to make cortisol, although typically it's usually in both, right? So if you have like decreased production of cortisol, right, from those adrenals, right, you will not have negative feedback. So your levels of ACTH will go up. And ACTH, again, remember I said very early in this podcast that ACTH is a stimulating factor for the adrenal glands, right? So ACTH will stimulate, for the adrenal cortex, sorry. So ACTH will stimulate both adrenal cortices because it's just high. So those people will have bilateral hyperplasia of the adrenal glands. So let's start with the most common one and the one you will likely see on your exam, 21-hydroxylase deficiency, right? The thing is 21-hydroxylase, right? It's actually an enzyme that you need to make cortisol. Again, remember I said all these enzyme deficiencies will cause cortisol problems, right? So 21-hydroxylase is required for a person to make cortisol, but it's also required for a person to make aldosterone, right? So the thing is, people that have 21-hydroxylase deficiency, their aldosterone levels will be low, their cortisol levels will be low. And one thing that's actually very high yield to remember is that they'll have increased levels of something known as 17-OHP. Well, what does 17-OHP stand for? 17-OHP is 17-hydroxyprogesterone, okay? Measurement of levels of 17-OHP is very instrumental, let me put it that way, on USMLE exams if you want to diagnose an individual with having a congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Okay, it is very instrumental on USMLE exams if you want to diagnose a person with congenital adrenal hyperplasia. So I promise you, you need to make sure you commit that agent to memory. It's one of those things in the pathway you do actually want to know, right? So the thing is, there are actually many types of 21-hydroxylase deficiency. There is one called like the salt wasting form. This is the one that will present in infancy as a child is born. You're like, man, this child is like super hypotensive, right? Because again, they're not making cortisol, right? So again, that permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system is not there, right? So they're like super hypotensive. And because they're not making aldosterone, right, they have hyperkalemia, they have hyponatremia, they have a metabolic acidosis. If you see that in a newborn, in an infant, that will be the salt wasting form on an MDME exam. And then there is one that is like late onset, you know, it can show up like in a person's teenage years. Again, they may, for the most part, the one that presents in people's teenage years, like the late onset form, some people call it like the non-classic form of 21-hydroxylase deficiency. For the most part, the only thing you'll see in those folks is just the androgen excess, right? So, you know, they may be hirsute, or they may have like acne, they may have like problems with like their menstruation and all that stuff. So that may be the thing you'll see in that non-classic form. And then there is one form known as the simple virilizing form. It's just basically the people that have the simple virilizing form, for the most part, they just have signs of virilization, you know. So if it's a woman, she can have like, she may have like hirsutism, she may have like really bad acne, she may have like masculinization. If it's a guy, he may have like precocious puberty kind of deal. But these people usually don't have the electrolyte abnormalities that you would expect from having low levels of aldosterone, right? So the only one I will say on the USMLE exams that you should peg as having like all these bad electrolyte abnormalities is the salt wasting form, the infantile, the newborn form of 21-hydroxylase deficiency. And again, if we're going off of those rules, right, I said 21, right, it doesn't have a 1 as the first number, but it has a 1 as the second number, right? So people that have 21-hydroxylase deficiency, they will have virilization, okay? They will have virilization, but they will not have hypertension, they will not have hypokalemia, they will not have metabolic alkalosis, okay? Now, 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency, right, basically, it essentially works like 21-hydroxylase, but it just sort of shows up above, it's the enzyme that's like needed like right above 21-hydroxylase, right? So the thing is, people that have 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency, they will actually not have increased levels of 17-hydroxyprogesterone. So their 17-OHP levels will be just fine, okay? But, sorry, making a mistake here. Because I was like, wait, these things don't make any sense to me. So, sorry, let me backtrack a little. When a person has 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency, the thing that happens is that they will actually have decreased... 11-beta-hydroxylase, I erroneously said that it comes before 21-hydroxylase. That's not true. 11-beta-hydroxylase comes after, one step after 21-hydroxylase, okay? It comes one step after 21-hydroxylase. But again, levels of 17-OHP are fine. In a person that has 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency, okay? Now, one key thing, I'll say this is probably the most critical thing you want to keep in mind with 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency, is that these people, they have, or maybe let me put it this way. What is one thing 11-beta-hydroxylase does? 11-beta-hydroxylase converts 11-deoxycorticosterone to corticosterone. Okay, it converts 11-deoxycorticosterone to corticosterone. So you may say, well, Divine, why are you making a big fuss about 11-deoxycorticosterone? Well, here's the deal. 11-deoxycorticosterone actually has partial activity at mineralocorticoid receptors. So if it has partial activity at mineralocorticoid receptors, it means you can get an aldosterone-like effect from 11-deoxycorticosterone. That is why if a person has 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency and their levels of 11-deoxycorticosterone goes up, right, they will have hypertension, because basically anything you expect with aldosterone excess, they will have. They will have hypertension, they will have hypokalemia, they will have metabolic alkalosis, okay? But again, because you are shunting so much stuff towards the androgen pathway, these people will also have virilization, okay? They will also have virilization. If it's a guy, though, you'll see more things more along the lines of precocious puberty, right? Because you're already a guy. So if you have more testosterone, you will almost be like a super guy, right? So you can have like precocious puberty. Basically, you become like a guy before you're supposed to become a guy at puberty. You kind of understand what I'm saying. I'm going to move on from that. So, and one thing that your friends at the NBME may do to you on an exam is to try to get you to see if you can piece apart differences between 21-hydroxylase deficiency in terms of like renin levels and 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency in terms of renin levels. Well, if a person has 21-hydroxylase deficiency, they are not making aldosterone, they are not making cortisol, they are not making 11-deoxycorticosterone, so they are hypotensive, right? So because they are hypotensive, they are renin, and there will be hypoperfusion of the afferent arterial, so those people actually have increased levels of renin, right? Contrast this with a person that has 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency. Because they have an aldosterone-like effect from 11-deoxycorticosterone, right? They actually, you know, retain sodium, retain fluid, so they are hypertensive. So there is hyperperfusion of the afferent arterial, so those people actually have decreased levels of renin, okay? Now, last one I guess I'll talk about is 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency. Basically, this one, if you're going with our rules, there's a 1 in the first number, so these people will have hypertension, but there's no 1 in the second number, so these people actually do not have virilization, okay? So basically, the thing that happens is that if a person has 17-hydroxylase deficiency, they actually make a crap ton of aldosterone, but they actually are not able to make androgens, and they're not able to make cortisol, okay? They're not able to make androgens, they're not able to make cortisol. And these people, I would hope that you understand that these people will have low levels of renin as well, because again, they have high levels of aldosterone, so they'll be hypertensive, okay? Now, one, I guess, subtle thing I should go ahead and mention is that people that have 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency, if they're female, right? The thing is, these females will actually look completely fine at birth, because Remember, you do not need androgens for a woman's external genitalia to look normal, right? Everything will be completely fine at birth, okay? But the thing is, when a guy is born, because you need, like, again, androgens for a guy's external genitalia to look normal at birth, those people have, like, ambiguous genitalia, right? They may even have, like, undescended testes. But the thing is, for puberty, in both males and females, you do need androgens that are alive and well, okay? You do need androgens that are alive and well, right? So those people will have, like, as they get to puberty, they'll begin to have problems with secondary sexual development, okay? Again, these are all high-yield things to know and understand for purposes of the USMLE exams. The thing is, I think I want to keep this under an hour. I would make an add-on adrenal podcast. It'll be much shorter than this one to just go over a few more topics that I have at the back of my mind. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, you need tutoring for the in-training exam or the ABI in-board exam, feel free to reach out to me. If you need, like, one-on-one tutoring or, you know, like, large group tutoring for any of these exams I've mentioned, just reach out to me through the website, or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And then if you know you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS app, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS app, I do offer like one-on-one coaching for these things. So like rec letters, personal statements, editing applications, mock interviews. Again, I've worked with tons of people, and most of the people I've worked with have actually matched at their first choices. And again, I actually have admissions committee experience. I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for a year, right? So again, I have a lot of experience reviewing very high quality applications. And then if, for example, you have like a college buddy that needs tutoring for like general chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, biochem, histology, physiology, I offer tutoring for all those things. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in the next podcast episode 192. Thank you, and God bless you.